Just behave yourselves and act like men.
Now you start using your head. That's not love. That's 3 feet above your ass.
People will come, Ray.
All right, don't try to strike everybody out. Strikeouts are boring. Besides that, they're fascist.
We don't stink right now.
You play ball like a girl!
You're out of here!
There's no crying in baseball!
High fly ball into right field. She is gone!
This is West Coast Bias.
Dynamite drop in, Monty. That broadcast school has really paid off.
Oh, yes. Yes, 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 yes. Thank you for joining us once again. We are back. I am Adam Nelson.
And I am Samuel Paul.
Remember to email us at baseballshowpodcast@gmail.com. Leave a comment. Leave your trivia answers. Leave your complaints. Leave your bra size. Facebook.
West Coast Bias Baseball.
Instagram?
Are we not
there?
Yet.
Are we
we're
there?
We're not on Instagram.
Are we thoroughly modern?
We're
not thoroughly modern.
No Twitter, no Insta.
We're getting there. Slowly but surely.
Maybe soon Reddit. We'll see.
Send your resumes. I think this show is a curse because the Reds just went back-to-back against the Dodgers as we speak right now, and the Dodgers had a 8-run shutout going, and I believe last time we were on this episode, Justin Verlander was getting smoked when, you know, generally I'm not really rooting for the Astros, but for fantasy purposes, you know, it allows me to cross barriers, it allows me to cross borders and root for people who I normally would spit on in the street. But, just kidding, Justin, I still love you. All right. It's all right. He's still killing it.
He decides he'd probably hit you if you spit on him on the street.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure he would. And that's okay. Either way, Dodgers are still winning. Although I did bench Dietrich and he just got a home run. So it's okay. We are back.
Solo shot.
That's all right.
It's
yeah.
Fine.
We're not going to do another distracted episode last week. Well, yeah, no promises. You're right. What's going on? We got a lot going on this week. You know, we were gone last week. A lot's happened, but I kind of just want to jump right into a little toe tap.
This happened last night.
Saturday evening, the Cubs game against the
Saturday
Nationals.
Evening.
Did you happen to catch
this
that?
May 18th. No, I did not. I did not do my diligence last night. I was far too tired after work to watch the highlights.
No excuses. Madden.
That's true.
Disputed Sean Doolittle's delivery, his toe tap, so to speak. He had a little toe tap, and you know, this has been an area of contention a lot this season, and they have not allowed anybody to do the toe tap, and Madden was especially pissed because they told Carl Edwards Jr. earlier in the season, I think it was the first series of the year against the Rangers, that he couldn't do that, and he actually got his ERA ballooned to like 9.45 that year and required a trip to the minors this year. So Madden was pissed, and rightfully so. I mean, you know, Doolittle was toe-tapping, you know, on his delivery. After he lifted his leg, you know, he's a lefty, so after he lifts his right leg, he comes back down, right foot touches the dirt before he delivers the ball. You can't do that. That's a buck. You know, so Madden jumps out. He's pissed. He's hollering. To the umpire's credit, he didn't kick him out. Was that Sam Holbrook? But the Cubs still played to a 5-2 loss under protest. And umpire let Doolittle finish the game. This is strange. This is pretty unusual, very unusual, considering the fact that during this game, the umpires had a meeting on the field, and they even had a rule check with, you know, the Chelsea umpires in New York or whatever, you know, and they still said, no, it's fine. What the hell's going on here?
I don't know. I think there's definitely sounds like there's a little bit of lack of consistency on enforcement, and no one is truly sure of what
they are. No,
this
they are
rule
sure.
Is about.
Well, they are sure. That's what Madden was talking about. That's why he's so mad, because they told him flat out, you cannot touch the dirt again with your lead foot after you begin your windup. And that's what they're saying. That's what they're telling him in this game. They're like, well, our judgment calls, you know, that it was fine. He's like, it has nothing to do with judgment. This is a black and white issue. He's either touching the dirt, right, or he's not. And he clearly was. And so he caught it during the warm-up pitches. This is the ninth inning. Now, the Cubs are already losing 5-2. But, you know, it's still not out of the question that they can come back.
Was this on a complete game effort?
No. Sean Doolittle. Yeah, okay. The Washington's closer. Came out to close the game. But during the warm-up pitches, Madden called it out. He said, you know, no, you can't do that. Because during that game in Texas earlier this year, same thing happened. Carl Edwards Jr. is going out there. He's tapping. And Texas dugout screaming, you can't do that. You can't do that. Can't do that. I remember Asdrubal Cabrera's at the plate. And they're hollering. And then sure enough, the umpire, you know, stops the game. And they make him stop doing that. You know, they didn't call a balk. I don't think there's going to be any on base. But, and again, that, you know, screwed Edwards up. I mean, because that's the way he had been training all spring training.
Right.
His ERA ballooned. He got sent to the minors. And so now, of course, Joe Maddon is a little bit more sensitive than the average manager because he lost a pitcher, essentially, due to this rule, which is a rule. And he was saying, he's like, I don't even like the rule, but it's not my rule. It's their rule, you know. You right. got to be consistent with this. This isn't a gray area.
But you said that they contacted New York. So what's right. that about?
Yeah. Yeah. It's I don't know. That's the thing that bothers me the most, is that they actually went to the rule check. You know, and they still permitted him to pitch the ninth. It's really strange. I mean, now, obviously, this is all still very fluid. I'm sure there's probably talks going on right now as we speak on this Sunday afternoon.
I would hope so.
Me as well, because this isn't something that is really debatable. I mean, you know, the umpire has held a conference near the mound, and they permitted him to do that. So the managers are permitted to protest a game, of course, when they allege that umpires have misapplied the rules, but MLB will determine later whether or not the protested decision violated the rules, though the game will not be replayed unless it is also determined that the violation adversely affected the protesting team's chances of winning, which sounds like it doesn't. Well,
but
it's three runs in the ninth. You know, it's not unheard of that a closer blows a save. You know, I think they're going to have to replay this. You know, because it's clear. It is clear. Now, of course, Doolittle is just saying, oh, Madden's just trying to get under my skin, blah, blah, blah. But he knows he's toe-tapping. I mean, they have the replay. It doesn't make any sense.
Is this the first time that anyone's ever called him out on this? How long has he been toe-tapping?
That's a good question.
Is this a new phenomenon, his windup?
That's a good question. I don't know.
And I know there has been a lot of windups in the past where a pitcher has come down and during delivery lead foot has touched and moved, you know, but to no adverse effect.
Well, once you lift your foot, you can't put it back down mid wind up
unless you take your foot off the rubber
or if you throw the ball
right
if that's your plant foot. But yeah, but you can't really take your foot off the rubber if you're only on one foot that's on the rubber, right? You can't really hop off like that. Your other foot has to be firmly planted, and you got to step off. You can't hop off, right?
But that foot's got to come down before you take your foot off the rubber anyway.
Right, and once it's down, it's got to stay down. You can't lift it up again and then put it down again. And that's essentially what he's doing. Whether it's a toe or the whole cleat, doesn't matter. His shoe is touching the ground. Anyway, speaking of pitching, how about Hyunjin Ryu? Came into the game, 24 scoreless innings. Went 7 against the Reds this Saturday afternoon. Scoreless. Now up to 31 straight scoreless innings.
Oh, that's pretty impressive.
It's very impressive. You know, it actually lowered his ERA down to 1.52.
Wow.
He's killing it.
Yeah.
If he can keep pitching, well, obviously if he can keep pitching this way, he'll win the Cy Young. But hopefully he can just stay healthy, you know, and pitch a full season. It'd be pretty remarkable if he keeps it under 2, even more so if he keeps it under 1.5. He's pitching great at home. He's pitching great on the road. I mean, the Great American Ballpark is not an easy park to pitch in. You know, that is a hitter's park. And Ryu is just looking great. So that's good news coming out of the Dodgers camp in the West. Now, there's a lot of talk with the West and one pitcher in particular, and yes, that would be your boy, Mr. Bummy, Mr. Madison Bumgarner. Now, what's going on here?
Well, as far as I can tell, really it's just a bunch of rumor and conjecture, but the talk is that Madison Bumgarner will be traded maybe well before the deadline in July. I don't see why that would necessarily have to happen that fast, but...
Before the deadline. I don't know about way before the deadline.
Well, that's what some people are suggesting. Had been suggesting it could be gone within the week.
Really?
I think this is just a little bit of Chicken Little saying the sky is falling. But, the fact remains that Madison Bumgarner is the Giants' best player and best trade piece to get some solid prospects in return,
which the Giants desperately need.
They do need, and this, whether Farhan Zaidi wants to call it a rebuilding process or not.
I think he has. I think he's pretty clear about a complete team rebuild, which I think is smart. That's why they didn't really spend any money this offseason, right?
And so these bunch of little changes have been happening here and there. Small trades and consequential trades, well, seemingly inconsequential trades, have been happening. But no big name blockbusters as of yet, but that kind of deal involving Madison Bumgarner would be a very big deal, and both teams involved would have to be satisfied with the value that they are getting for the players involved.
Right, and the Giants aren't, as far as I can tell, looking for a blockbuster trade. They're not looking for some big acquisition. They're looking for a few.
No, but it would be a blockbuster trade because of Madison Bumgarner's involved.
Oh, I see. But it would only be really a one-sided. Well, I mean, not one-sided, but in terms of
a blockbuster deal is a blockbuster deal. No,
it's not Yelich for Bumgarner. You know, it's not
right. But it is still a prominent name. One could argue baseball royalty at this point. But
I wouldn't argue that. But I would admit that he is easily one of the best postseason pitchers in modern history, and could easily help any contending team go forward in and through October, and which leads us to the list of his no trade list isn't 100% confirmed, right? But it's pretty much. So sources confirmed that it's eight teams, right? Braves, Red Sox, Cubs, Astros, Brewers, Yankees, Phillies, Cards.
Right. All of the potential playoff teams around the league.
Now, Bumgarner chose these teams strategically.
Of course.
Solely a list of contenders, essentially. Not teams he wants to avoid. But he's looking for maybe some compensation from the Giants, right, in the tune of possibly seven figures, just to help lubricate that trade, so to speak. He will waive his rights if something else gets done, right? Or, and you had a theory of possible extension later down the line.
Well, sure. I think Bumgarner has said in the past that he wishes to remain a Giant.
Now, do you think that he does? I mean, the goal for every major league player, I'm assuming, is to win a championship. Well, now, he already has three.
You would certainly hope that would be the goal of any Major League Baseball player, is to win the World Series.
But just because he has three, does that mean that he's not as hungry to win more and that he's willing to toil away in the Giants as they rebuild? I mean, we saw the Padres have been rebuilding for years, and just now are they starting to see like a glimmer of hope. Bumgarner doesn't have five, six more years to just wait around for the Giants to get good. Do you really think he wants to stay a Giant? Has he said that publicly?
I believe that he has said that publicly. I don't know how recent that statement was, but he has said that publicly, that he wants to remain a Giant for life. Now, if that means hanging around for some lean years while the team around him gets built back up, I don't think... hopefully it won't be 5-6 years.
Right. The last seven years have been lean. Right?
We're so. not well And in theory, you know, it's been lean since Barry Bonds left.
Well, they've won three. They've won three,
but all three of those winning years, they were not favored to win. They were not in 2010. True. They were not even mentioned in any sort of postseason talks.
Right, but what they did have was a team of strong, young, scrappy dudes, which is right. essentially the opposite of what they have right now. Now they have old, withering, powerless dudes, essentially, that they really need a new team.
Well, the young, scrappy have turned have definitely aged over the 9 years
right.
that it's been since 2010 when Buster Posey and Madison Bumgarner came up in their rookie years to propel the Giants to victory against Texas. Tim Lincecum, Matt Cain were already on the team for a few years. Matt Cain went through Madison Bumgarner might be looking at if he wants to remain a Giant, and being the best pitcher on a otherwise listless team.
Okay, so devil's advocate. He gets a sort of handshake deal by the Giants saying, listen, we're going to trade you, but at the end of the season, when you're a free agent, we're going to re-sign you. Okay, what if he goes to a team that wins it all? Is he really going to have that same juice? Is he going to honor that little handshake deal? You know what I mean? Like, is,
well, being a free agent, I think, you know, the Giants may want not to let him go, may want to re-sign him, but I think that the handshake deal would have to be more of a, you know, negotiate with us in good faith kind of thing. Yeah, if he wins it all, he might be tempted to stay with that team. But
right.
the idea is, hey, you know, we're serious about re-signing you. This is our offer. You know, what can we do to have you back kind of thing. We didn't, you know.
Right.
And if he turns into a true rental by a team, that would be an interesting scenario to contemplate.
Now, the Brewers are on this list, of the no-trade list.
He could be crushing beers with the Uke at the end of the season.
Well, possibly. But the Brewers already called up their number one prospect, Keston Hiura. So they don't really have as much to offer him offer the Giants as maybe somebody like the Padres. Now, it is the same division, of course, but the Padres have one of the most loaded systems in baseball. They have starting pitchers for the Giants. They have Adrian Morjon, Logan Allen. They have a bunch of pitchers, right? They have a lot of some speedsters in there as well. Buddy Reed, Josh Naylor for power. Padres have a lot to offer. And the Brewers obviously don't. I was thinking the Brewers might be the closest team, but now it seems like Giants don't even need to talk with Bumgarner. They don't even need to give him that $1 million or whatever the heck he wants. If they can just give him to the Twins, and the Twins have a good amount of pitching prospects, as well, and they wouldn't even have to ask his permission. They just get rid of him. You know, is that something you think the Giants would do? Do you think they would want to give him $1 million or so? I mean, that's the rumor. Maybe like a low seven figures to get him to waive the no trade clause, or do you think they'll just say, no, you're going to Tampa, they're not on that list, or you're going to Minnesota? Now, of course, we know the Rays farm system is loaded as well. They got Jesus Sanchez, Vidal Brujan, top pitching prospect Shane McClanahan. You know, so they don't need his approval, essentially, the Giants. They don't need Bumgarner's approval. They only need his approval for seven or eight of those teams, right? But there are some other, I mean, the Twins are still doing pretty damn good, and it looks like it's their division to lose at this point, right? So
that's true. I really wouldn't even pretend to know how these people think, but if
he gets traded to one of these teams without his permission, does he still have the same good faith with the Giants that he does?
Well, I seriously doubt it, but you know, at this point, he's won his rings. He can go anywhere that he wants. He can follow the money.
He can't go anywhere that he wants. I mean, not at least
as a free agent at the end of the year.
At the end of the year. Sure.
At the end of the year, you know, the Giants are free to extend him a contract offer during his free agency, and he is totally free to, you know, say yes. I'm back on board. Bring me back 100%. I will do it. And he also can say, no, screw you. You traded me to a team that I didn't want to go, and I finished the season in last place like I would have if... if
strike one.
You know, so I'm not gonna sign with you. I'm going to sign with the next best offer, which is, you know, a contending team or a competing team like the Dodgers.
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't think that's going to happen.
No, I don't think he'd become a Dodger either, but the Dodgers could certainly offer him a huge contract. Yeah. You have a 1-2 lefty punch at Kershaw and Bumgarner coming at you for Dodgers starting five.
That would just be too weird. That would just
it would be very strange.
It'd be like in San Francisco or something, you know. It's just that's a little too much for my...
It's weird enough seeing Puig in the Reds uniform.
But. I know. Speaking of which, he got a great catch today in foul territory. Looked like he banged up his elbow a little bit. Keep an eye on that. Speaking of pitchers, though. Okay, today, what is it, the 19th? May 19th? Yes. Marks the one-year anniversary that the Tampa Rays changed the game yet again, as they always seem to do, by reintroducing the concept of the opener. On May 19th, Sergio Romo came out for his first career start after 588 games in relief, struck out Zach Cozart, struck out Mike Trout, and then struck out Justin Upton in a perfect inning, as the Rays went on to win 5-3. Now, obviously, we've seen a few other teams do this. Of course, we saw the Brewers do this in the postseason last year.
Right.
So, question is, does it work? Has it been working? And will we continue to see it 1 year into this great experiment? The Rays had a 4.45 ERA as a team heading into that first game, the ninth highest in baseball. They have since had a 2.85 ERA since, by far the best in baseball. So, was the opener a success? Is it a success?
I wouldn't go so far as to call it a success, but it is definitely trending that way. You think that the Tampa Bay has a leg up because they probably have thought about it the longest since they were the first team to try it. They had may continue to have the correct personnel to make something like that work. The Giants just last week tried an opener for the first time in their history. It didn't go so well.
How did that go?
it did not go so well. I might as well have
you're
just...
Yeah,
pretty much.
Was that Sandoval?
It was not Sandoval. Sandoval did not start that game.
Maybe it should have been.
Maybe it should have been. It had a great quote from him about pitching, but... finding the right person with the right mentality to go out and start a game and then bring, someone else in the second inning. You have to find the right guys to be able to do that.
Well, of course, we've talked about the first inning is the highest scoring inning in baseball. So it makes sense on paper. If it works, of course. If it doesn't work,
if it works, you know. But the batter's eyes are the freshest. The legs are the freshest. They're, you know, not necessarily burdened by what happened last time. But they come out there and find a guy who's out there just for three batters, like a closer in the very first inning, makes hitting that pitcher a lot more difficult potentially than someone who's out there who wants to go 100 plus pitches and pitch, you know, well into the late innings.
Right. Yeah. And look, they still had the Cy Young Award winner, so it's not like they didn't have any good starting pitching. So there's kind of like a hybrid team in that sense, right?
Well, I mean, you're not going to have an opener for someone like Snell, but you're going to, for your four or five on the rotation guys, maybe not having them go out for that first inning, that adrenaline pumping, the pressure is on, get off to a good start, and have just a guy go out there just wants to blow the guys away. I mean, like, Romo's an interesting pitcher because he has been a closer and a successful one at that.
Right.
So he goes out there to start a game with the mentality of a closer, go out there, get the three outs, and then take the rest of the afternoon off after a job well done.
That actually probably would be ideal, especially if you're getting paid the same.
Especially if you're getting paid the same. Now, for fantasy purposes, opener comes out, does that get counted as a hold? No one gets on, no one scores?
Maybe if you are at home, or maybe if you're away. I don't know. I don't know how that would work. If your team scores first and then you pitch the bottom of the first, I don't know. We need a new stat line. It's going to take a little while. Although,
it's obviously it's not a quality start, or is it?
No, definitely not. And there's even some murmuring about upping quality start to 7 innings, 3.
That'll never happen then.
Never say never. I had Frankie Montas go 8 2/3 the other night, Friday night. And Bob Melvin decided to pull him with 2 outs in the 9th in a blowout where Montas was raking. Cost me a complete game.
Yeah, well, you need to draft some pitchers from places where it rains.
Well, I know. Like you, apparently. Yeah. That happened a couple times already. Correct,
yeah.
A 5-inning complete game.
5-inning complete game because
outrageous.
Outrageous. Game called due to weather.
That really sucked. Yeah, that really... in a fantasy league where you count complete games, it is the most sought-after stat because it can jump you like 5 points overnight. It could potentially pop you 10 or 12 points depending on how many players are in your league if you do roto, because it's such a hard stat to get. I think probably fewer than half the people in our league even have one yet, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there's only been a handful. But anyway, what are you going to do? It's all right. This is kind of a pitcher-friendly episode. Do you know anything about this Ryan Feyerbend?
Fires? Mike Fires?
No, not Mike Fires. Ryan Feyerbend. How about Feyerbend? Does that count?
No, that name does not ring a bell.
Well, he's a lefty pitcher that has a pitch that hasn't been seen in nearly 20 years.
Really?
Yeah. What kind of pitch do you think he has as a lefty that we haven't seen in 20 years? I mean, how many pitches are there? It's not a spitball.
Well, that would be illegal. I would have heard about that. Screwball, perhaps?
No. Although that's interesting. Gerald Cotton had a screwball. Was he a righty or a lefty? I don't know. He's actually rehabbing right now for the A's. No, a knuckler.
A knuckler. Yeah, a left-handed knuckler.
A left-handed knuckler. He was. They called him up from AAA Buffalo, where he had a 2.70 ERA in 3 starts. But he actually has an arsenal of pitches, so the knuckleball just being one of them, which makes him even more rare, especially for a lefty. The most recent lefty knucklers would be Rich Savor. I don't know. Retired in 2000. Had a nice 14-year career. And Kurt Ohala, 97 and 99, very short career. But very rare to see a lefty knuckler. So we'll see how Ryan Feyerbend does for the Blue Jays.
Is he a starter or a reliever?
Oh, should be a starter, as far as I know. I mean, he was starting in AAA. I'm assuming he'll be a starter. But yeah, that's interesting. I mean, especially if a guy can throw in the 90s and then throw a knuckleball.
It'll make that fastball look even that much faster. Followed up with a floater and then a wicked curve. That's a rough AB.
Toronto had what was the Cy Young Award winner? The knuckler.
Necro?
No. More recently, he won it with the Mets.
Wakefield?
No, even more recently. He won it with the Mets, and then he got traded. He was like one of the first times a Cy Young Award winner got traded in the offseason.
Right. Name is right there.
R.A. Dickey. Jesus Christ, it's been a long week. I'm sorry, everybody out there. I know everybody's screaming right now. It's R.A. Dickey. But, I haven't heard of R.A. Dickey in a long time.
Yeah, so. I haven't heard his name.
But he was kind of similar. He had that, he had about three or four pitches, so it wasn't just a knuckleball. Because if it's just a knuckleball 100% of the time, the guys have a slight advantage, or at least, guys can sit on it and
wait for it.
Do some
be
damage.
Patient for it. Yeah,
exactly. But we also have a pitcher going into the record books.
We do.
I
thought you have that.
Oh yeah, drum roll.
Hey, you got the soundboard.
Yeah, that's Edwin Jackson.
Edwin Jackson
for the 14th. Big league team of his career, the Toronto Blue Jays. On Wednesday, nobody has ever pitched for that many teams before. Now, it's possible nobody ever will again, seeing as how there isn't an active pitcher with within five teams of him, unless you count Bartolo Colon, but he hasn't really made any retirement announcements lately, so we'll see. But he took the record from one Octavio Dotel. Now, Dotel owned that record for 6 years all by himself. And as far as I can tell, he loved it. That was like his claim to fame. And I'm pretty sure he was pretty butthurt when Edwin Jackson took it from him. He actually quoted as saying, "I got traded 3 times in 1 year. He never did that. He got released 3 times. See, I'm better than him. I never got released. 11 Hall of Famers to one. There you go." Now, that's what I'm talking about. Yeah, if you got released, that's cheating, Dotel keeps talking. So he's cheating because he got released 3 times. Should those count? Hell no. Don't count those, please. End quote.
But it's not the number of times that you've been traded, it's the amount of teams that you paid
for. That's true, it's true.
No, I get it. If you get traded by a team, they don't want you, not because they necessarily think you're bad, just so they think they can get someone better. If you just get outright released by a team,
that's ignoble.
They're just saying, "We don't want you anymore."
Please don't count those. That's pretty good. Now, Dotel has a 6-pitcher no-hitter, whereas Edwin Jackson has a no-hitter all to himself. I don't know what Dotel's, he's talking about. He had 11 Hall of Fame teammates, and Jackson only had one. But I don't know what that has to do with you as a pitcher, who your teammates are. But fun fact, though, Dotel faced Adrian Beltre for 8 teams. And Edwin Jackson faced Andrew McCutchen for 8 teams. Pretty interesting.
Yeah, now they've played for 7 teams in common.
Oh, okay.
And those teams are the A's, the Blue Jays, the Braves, the Cardinals, the Dodgers, the Tigers, and the White Sox. Both Edwin Jackson and Octavio Dotel have
so they have a lot of teams in common.
A lot of teams in common, as one might suspect when playing for so many teams. There's got to be some sort of crossover,
right? That's actually quite a few. Now, if there wasn't any crossover, then it would pretty much be every team in baseball,
right?
Essentially.
But there are looks like 9.
Well, yeah, there's gonna be a double digits.
There's 10
yeah.
teams.
Yeah.
10 teams that neither player has pitched for thus far. Edwin Jackson's career is not over, so this list might change.
That's true.
But
as Dotel says, he was released 0 times, whereas Edwin Jackson was released 3 times.
So. In the middle of the season, or just at the end of the season, conclusion of this contract?
I don't know. According to Dotel, probably in the middle, but who knows? But this, brings me to a topic that I'm not too keen to even discuss.
You're a goddamn disgrace!
I'm not, but the potential electronic strike zone coming to the Atlantic League, which we briefly talked about a couple months ago, but next month, the time-honored tradition of calling Steve, you know, okay, gone.
For those of you listening at home,
gone.
Adam has just made a motion like he's calling someone out on strikes.
Yes.
Not quite as involved as, you know, the Naked Gun, but...
right. Strike? Yeah. umpire's jobs will never be the same.
I think they'll be a little bit easier myself.
So the first step was scheduled for this last Thursday, when Atlantic League parks in Bridgewater, New Jersey, and New Britain, Connecticut, were set to be the first to test the new technology. Now, it won't happen in actual games for, or even with actual pitch tracking until they get the umps up to speed, essentially. So it's still right now a test, but they are tracking it with this TrackMan system. And then just
right, well, every major league ballpark is already outfitted with this system.
And we have the pitch track, but they don't have the track man, which is like literally on the field, as far as I can tell, from both angles, not just the reverse and front angle, as far as I can tell. Kind of like golf, you know, that's what they use. They use the track man, and you can see him on the tees, essentially, like right next to it. So I don't know where they're going to be, if they're going to be... you know, on either side of the plate, all the way toward like toward the wall. I don't know. I honestly, and so the whole thing, man. The technology is close, sure, but even if the technology is near perfect, is it still a good idea? Now, I obviously I'm a bit of a traditionalist, but I mean, look, it's a human game played by human beings. Sometimes the call goes your way. Sometimes it doesn't. It's maddening at times, but at the same time, it's a game. You know, it'll never be 100%. Even with instant replay, it's not 100%. You need some sort of electron microscope with a camera on the end of it, getting down to the bag, getting down to like the grain, the pebbles of sand, to see if you really want to know who's out at second, or if he's safe, or first base for that matter. It'll never be perfect. So why are we trying to lie to ourselves and say that it could be perfect? Oh, if we only had the pitch track, if we only had the electronic strike zone, everything would be great. Would it?
Well, I think that the arguments over balls and strikes would come to an end.
I don't think so.
Well,
I don't think so. If anything, it's going to get worse if there's a robot. Because people, I mean,
well, you can't argue
human beings
a robot.
Have mercy for other human beings, even if it's an ump that blows a call. We do not have mercy for a robot. Absolutely not. There's going to be trash cans filled with these TrackMans. You've seen Big Poppy smashing a Gatorade jug with a bat. You're going to go straight to that TrackMan on the field, smash that $400,000 system, because it'll make the headlines and it'll feel great. I'm sure it will feel great. And again, the kinks aren't all out, right?
Well, there'll always be kinks, and you're right. It'll never be perfect, but being as close to perfect as possible is always going to be the goal.
Is it, though? I mean, this is a subjective game. It's meant to be played but, like that. It's not meant to be played in a vacuum.
But the rule for the strike zone is not written in a subjective way.
It's written by human beings who understand the
rules and the rule books define a specific strike zone,
right?
And where the human element comes from is purely the umpire trying to draw a mental picture of what that strike zone would look like in front of him. And have to hold that picture and watch a 90-mile-an-hour pitch come in, and does it enter that strike zone or not?
Right. Now, these aren't just chumps off the street. These aren't guys like you and me. These are highly trained professionals.
Absolutely.
Devoted their entire lives to this.
True.
You were saying the average Major League Baseball umpire has 13 years of professional experience on average? That's pretty good when you consider that it's a younger and younger crop of guys now. I think the average age is something like 44, 46 years old. So, look, I get it. You know, the older an ump gets, the worse his eyes get. But, you know, there's LASIK surgery for that. I get it. They're standing the entire game. They never get to take a break, you know. Each team gets to take a break every three outs. Umpires don't. I get it. And who was it? Boston University master lecturer Mark T. Williams and his team of graduate students have been studying this, and they found that in 2018, umpires made 34,294 incorrect ball and strike calls, which is 14 per game. Okay, but how many of those calls would be messed up with the TrackMan system? We don't know. So we're just going to roll the dice and say, oh, all right, screw it. Let's just see what that happens. I mean, how accurate will an electronic umpiring system be when put in daily use? How consistent will it be? How consistent will it be with a guy like Aaron Judge and then a guy like Jose Altuve? You know, strike zones change. Guys change their stance.
These are the same problems that a human umpire would have to contend with.
Right, but a human umpire can do it in real time.
Why couldn't a robot do it?
Because as far as I know, because it's all ones and zeros. You have to plug in the information. You have to say Altuve is 5'6". His strike zone is this big, this wide. Aaron Judge is this tall. Okay, so the computer has all that data, and then they can make live, real-time assessments based on that data. But what about somebody like Joey Votto? If you watch Joey Votto on an 0-0 count, he's a lot more erect. He's a lot more upright. He's holding the end of the bat. He's got an 0-2 count. He's hunched over. He looks like old-timey, like, you know, Wee Willie Keeler. He looks crazy. He's choked up. His strike zone, I know it doesn't shrink, but it kind of does, right? I mean, it kind of does.
Well, if it's defined by defined top to bottom as the knees to the letters,
right?
It does change. Right. I mean, that was one of the things where Ricky Henderson has squatted down with
right.
his backside stuck
yeah.
out,
yeah.
and his strike zone was very short,
right?
Is one of the things that made him difficult to pitch to.
So you think that the strike zone remains the same no matter what you do, no matter what stance, no matter what kind of crouch you do? Because I don't think that this TrackMan can capture that in real time.
Well, it depends on the technology that they're using. If they're using a theoretical box, the system that is in place now at all 30 Major League Baseball stadiums tracks the position of the ball 50 times. Between the time that it leaves the pitcher's hand and the time that it enters the strike zone. And it's accurate to within an inch.
Within 1 inch. Okay. That doesn't sound like a lot, but an inch can make or break a World Series. An inch is everything in baseball. If it's only accurate within an inch, a human being could do that.
And an inch is less than the diameter of a baseball.
Right.
So we're talking about a very small margin of error comparatively over the distances and the speeds. Now, this can only get better, but we're talking about an article I found from Boston University, a study of nearly 4 million pitches over a period of 10 years showed that umpires are making mistakes to the tune as 20% of the calls are wrong, and 2.2% of all the games played and the 2018 season ended on a missed call
according to a computer.
According to the analysis of data provided by a computer.
Right. So that's assuming that the computer is infallible and that it's completely 100% accurate. Because I'm just not convinced that it is.
But it works both ways. This same computer on computer analysis and Mike Fiers' complete game no-hitter last week. Showed that the umpire of that game made his calls 100% accurate, did not miss a pitch.
Interesting.
So
100%.
100%. The computer graded the umpire for that game at 100%.
Wow. Okay.
So.
Okay. So, but what's is there a discrepancy between, let's say, older managers over 55 and managers under 55 or over 60 and under 60?
Well, this same article does address that. And yes, there is a difference. What it found was that the older veteran umpires, average age of 46 years old, 13 years of experience, but the top performers between 2008 and 2018 had an average of 33 years old and less than 3 years experience.
Wait, hold on. So you're saying the average of major league umpires is 46 years old.
Well,
just the average in general, but the
top performers.
The top performers
had an average age of 33 and had less than 3 years of experience.
Wow.
So there seems to be a peak of age in umpires like there are in players.
Now, okay, that's interesting. Oh, so okay, look. Yeah, so umpires get old, they get tired. Maybe there needs to be an age limit possibly. Okay. That's interesting. I'd be willing to talk about that. That's an interesting concept, and to have them be evaluated, I know they wouldn't ever sign on board with that, so it always had to be probably unofficial, but maybe there'd be some wiggle room where they can accept yearly evaluations to keep their job, essentially.
Only the best at doing this. I mean, yeah. They're human; they're allowed mistakes, but at a rate of 20% on average is that's.
You think that's untenable?
That's more than one, missed call per inning.
Okay.
And that can affect the outcome of a game. It can affect strategy.
It's possible, but could some of those numbers be really talking about how veteran umpires call games? It's not always black and white, right? If Kyle Hendricks is hitting his spots low and inside and is right on the border all game, and the guy's efficient, the guy's averaging 11 pitches per inning, which he essentially did a couple weeks ago when he threw like a 86 game complete game shutout. You give him that corner, right? And a veteran umpire gets that. He's not going to give him the outside corner, but if he's getting that inside corner to lefties constantly as a righty, he's going to get that. And so a computer might not call that a strike, but if an umpire, and probably a veteran umpire because they understand this concept, is calling that consistently, is that out of the question? Is that crazy?
Well, I know this happened. I remember what comes to mind when you're talking about that is watching Tom Glavine.
Well, Glavine is the notorious because he got calls way off the plate.
Right.
No, and I'm not. Yeah, okay. All right, yeah.
So, I mean, this happens. I mean, yeah, if you see a pitcher that's hitting the same spot time after time after time, if it's a borderline, pitcher's probably going to get that pitch.
Right, and you have a problem with that.
Well,
in theory,
in theory, yeah, I do. I mean, because it's the ball's not a strike. You know, it's consistent. It's showing precision on the pitcher's part, but not accuracy. It's not within that theoretical box that is the strike zone. You know,
Glavine is an extreme example,
even if we allow for that inch of error, an inch of error off the plate in either direction is not so far out of the realm of what you're just talking about of a pitcher hitting a spot over and over, even if it is slightly outside the strike zone, is hit so consistently that it looks like a strike.
Now, I would be really interested to see, and obviously we can't do this, but because the technology didn't exist before 2005 or so, but it'd be really interesting to see the evolution of umpires and calls, because I'm sure, or I have a feeling that, 60s, 70s, 80s, into the 90s, guys were getting calls way outside, more so than now. I would be willing to bet, and of course, there's, again, there's no way to actually look this up, but that the strike zones have been getting tighter in the last 25 years.
I bet possible.
That
Glavin
pitch
also,
is never going to get called anymore. Like, umps are, as far as I can tell, a lot less liberal, right? Now,
well, and I
they
think
sometimes
also
make mistakes,
I think
sure.
I think this is also a thing, too, because now the games are so televised and the camera work is so good that they can be scrutinized more. Before, I wouldn't be surprised if there wasn't any difference in error rates going back to the dawn of time to now. It's just now every pitch is looked at. Every pitch is analyzed. Everyone can see how far off the plate that ball really was. Not just the umpire, catcher, batter, and maybe one of the players from either dugout would be able to see. But again, it's hard to see from the side how far outside that pitch from Glavin was.
So it's it's not like it's a pressing issue, though, right? Because if anything, the strike zones are getting tighter because, like you said, the umpires are getting more scrutinized and they don't want to get blasted on Twitter or wherever.
But they still manage to.
Right, because, like, as you said, it's all every... But now every damn channel, every game I watch now has the permanent strike zone, which I still loathe. It used to just be during nationally broadcast games
or
it used
replay.
To just be ESPN. Now it's everywhere. Yeah. I'm getting used to it to an extent. But I think that... I don't think that the issue is that pressing that it needs to be addressed immediately, like they're trying to do in the Atlantic League, like they're trying to, like they did
well,
up here in
and the
in
the Atlantic League. You know, the minor leagues is a test bed for all things major leagues, so we're going to see how it works. What you know fallacies the system has, what it does well.
Yeah,
you gotta try it somewhere.
Okay, but so there's still a few question marks, like. Will it be possible to trick, quote-unquote, trick the system with a pitch that hits the front of the plate and then bounces through the zone, for example? Probably. Now, if anything, that's probably just... That'll probably be, like, a cool... a decent perk, I guess, to see that, to see guys create ways to trick the TrackMan system. Because you know there's going to be. Are we going to see the Ephus pitch way more? Probably, you know? I mean, in that case, it would kind of be interesting to watch, but it's still not really worth it. The big one, though, is will pitchers be willing to accept ball calls on borderline pitches that catchers are currently working extremely hard to frame as strikes, such as, you know, the fabled backdoor slider, right? Or is that just gone now?
Well, you know, the
frame rate out the window.
That's the cost of accurate calls is. If you're going to call a objective defined strike zone that is electronically generated, and you know to get the most accurate calls, if you miss the strike zone, it's a ball. No matter if you used to get that pitch or not, the computer says that that's outside the strike zone. The umpire is there still to confirm it with his own eyes. Because maybe there is an accuracy or that ball did bounce in front of the plate. But for the most part, if that ball is right there but just below or just outside or just inside and they don't get the call, you still can't argue it.
Oh, but they're gonna argue it.
But they still they're not supposed to argue now, and they do. The consequences will be the same. Nothing, and that will change.
Man, I don't know.
Now you know. Here we've argued these balls and strikes because he's human. He makes mistakes. So now we have an electronic eye that's actually aiding the umpire to calling these balls and strikes. And you're upset with a call, but if the computer calls a certain way and umpire agrees, then that's a ball.
So frame rate is out the window. I know it's a relatively new stat, but that's gone. That is 100% gone.
There's I think no, so.
Well,
because you're not. I mean, because when I was learning how to umpire for Little League, same job, a little bit less difficult because of the speeds involved.
A little bit.
But it's still a tough job.
Sure.
But it was always, it's the strike zone starts at the front of the plate, and it only matters where the ball is as it
passes the
crosses plate. Yeah. The threshold of the front of the plate. If it's in the strike zone at that point, it's a strike. Doesn't matter if it's at the bottom and then falls out. And it ends
what
up
if
low?
It never goes through the plate? What if it drops onto the plate but starts as a strike? That's a strike. That wouldn't be called a strike right now.
Well, there's. I don't think I've ever seen an instance where the ball has hit the plate that started the thing.
But if it's a
big overhand Barry Cito's style curve that has that long arc that comes through the top of the strike zone comes through the strike zone, it's still a strike.
That's what I'm talking about. If the ball doesn't even pass the plate, what if the ball lands on the plate? I'm talking about these trick pitches. See,
these trick pitches are so rare. Show me an example.
They are now.
I don't.
The good old fashioned EFIS. That's coming back. I'm going to make my pitching resurgence at age 43.
Because
I can throw a ball 48 miles an hour. Yeah, I think I can do that. I've been to the state fair. I hit 48, 49. I hit 50. I can do it. I'm telling you, man, this is going to open a whole can of worms. It's gonna have so many side effects that we can't even think of right now.
So the strategy of baseball lives on in spite of the... in spite of the technology,
but that's a different game.
The play of the game with the changing of the rules has been a thing since the beginning.
Yeah, but not changing of the game. Changing a few rules, sure. Infield fly rule, yeah, that needed to be made. That rule needs to be there. Okay, fine. It wasn't always there. I get it. Okay, there are a lot of rules that are stupid. The DH, that's a stupid rule. It's ridiculous. You know, just because it's a rule doesn't mean it's good. There's still no need for that, and there's still no upside to that at all whatsoever.
Did it change the game in a drastic way?
Oh, hell yeah, it changed the game. American League managers, I don't even think they deserve an award. You know, there's a National League Manager of the Year, American League Manager of the Year. No, just have it be one Manager of the Year, and every year it's going to be from the National League because they're playing a different game. They actually have to strategize. They have to do double switches. They have to think about this stuff. They have to, you know, the guy has to get out there every nine at bats. You know, the pitcher's got to get out. He has to think about that. That's weighing on him. American League Manager of the Year. Get out of here. It's an oxymoron. All right.
American League fans, send your hate mail.
Yeah, look. I'm talking to you, Bob Melvin. All right. Let me just. Let me calm down here.
Your opinion.
All right. Let's just do some. All right. Screw it. That brings us to this week's Ignoble Award of the Week. Which probably could have been that whole last diatribe, but you have this week's Ignoble Award of the Week. What do you got for me this week?
This week the Ignoble Award that I found. Most worthy was a little stat comparison I found between the Miami Marlins.
Okay.
Right state, wrong team. The Miami Marlins offense versus the New York Met pitchers offense.
Huh? Oh no.
Oh no.
Oh no, I see where this is going. Oh no. Oh no. So
I found this little stat chart here. The New York Mets pitchers this year so far are batting .202 with a OBP of .227. Well, so it's not great, but no, there's the pitchers.
They're not necessarily bad to hit, but it's
respectable.
Sure.
as a staff. Slugging percentage of .369 and OPS of .596.
Yeah.
So these are the Mets pitchers. So let's look at the team stats for the Marlins. The entire team. The average, .218. Okay, so a little bit better. Not great, but a little bit better. OBP, .281. Again, a little bit better. Not great, but still better than the pitchers of the Mets. Slugging percentage, though, they're only slugging .307.
Jesus.
As a team.
Jesus.
With an OPS of .587.
Good.
As a team.
What was the Mets' OPS?
.596.
Oh, God.
Not so much worse, but still worse. But again, we're talking about the pitchers of the Mets versus the entire team of the Miami Marlins.
Oh, that's shameful.
It really is. So that's my ignoble award of the week to the Miami Marlins team offense for not producing as well as the New York Mets pitchers.
Jesus, that's brutal. And I was going to give it to Bryce Harper, but that would have been too easy. Wow, that is terrible. Okay, well, that's, you know what, Marlins? I mean, I hope you're rebuilding. I don't know what
that. I hope it works.
I don't know what's, yeah.
We'll see in a couple years. We'll see what happens.
Oh,
but.
Jeter. We hardly knew you. Vladimir Guerrero Jr. became the first son of any home run derby champ to homer in a park where his dad once won a derby.
Yes.
How about that?
I was there for that.
Oh, you were at that game.
I was
Vladdy's
at that
first
game.
Home runs.
Yeah.
Wow, it's a moot, dude. He hit it like .460 or something,
man,
straight center field, like
it
the hardest park to hit him. It's insane. Yeah. That center field's where balls go to die. It
really is. And it makes me more and more think that the Giants' inability to hit home runs at Oracle Park is completely mental.
Psychosomatic, yeah. I think you're right.
These visiting teams, they don't have any problems hitting home runs. Big home runs
right.
In that park.
Yeah, monster shot.
You know, so
a 19-year-old
it's just
kid
mental. Just hit it
plate.
Harder. Get a better swing on that ball. You know, these guys can hit it out.
I'm glad you could see that. Maybe the Giants are the last team to adapt or adopt, not exit velocity, but exit... What's the...
launch angle?
Launch angle. Thank you. Jesus. It's been a long day. Yeah, launch angle. I mean, look, I'm not saying go up there and golf swing everything, but, I mean, maybe there is something to it. Maybe they're not doing that. I don't know.
They just don't have the hitter's power to do it, which is too bad. Historically, Giants have always been a home run hitting team. They're one of the first teams to hit 10,000 home runs for as a franchise.
Well, yeah. Gone are those days. So, Vladdy becomes the first son of any Derby champ to hit one in a Derby. But there have been three fathers who have homered in a park where their sons later won a Derby.
Hmm.
Can you name?
Well, I would say
the easiest.
Griffey.
Griffey's, yeah. Twice. Once at Fenway and at Three Rivers, yeah.
Okay.
We also have the...
Bonds. Right.
Yes. And Bobby. At Veterans Park in Philadelphia, which of course doesn't exist anymore, and the pound for pound Kings, which we talked about last year,
be the Fielders.
Correct. Kauffman Stadium, yeah, 12 actually there. That's they have the lead, but
well, that is AL Central, I imagine.
It's pretty cool, yeah. It's pretty good stuff. So Bryce Harper won the Home Run Derby last year, as we know. But he's winning a whole different kind of derby this season. The good news is that he leads the league in walks. The bad news is he also leads the league in strikeouts. Now, Aaron Judge did that in the American League just 2 years ago. And the AL list has all sorts of names that you can pull out. Babe Ruth, Mickey Mantle, Jim Thome, Jack Cuss, Jason Giambi, even, of course, the big donkey, Adam Dunn. But for some reason, this doesn't really ever happen in the National League. Why is that? In fact, it's only happened, looks like, three times since 1930.
In the National League.
Yeah, yeah. So he's joining an exclusive, if he continues, of course,
right.
Down this road.
Still early in the season.
Yeah, in which the ball never leaves the batter's box in nearly half of his at-bats. He joined an exclusive club of men who have led the NL in walks and whiffs in the past 100 years. That'd be Dale Murphy in 85, Mike Schmidt in 83. Then you got to go all the way back to Dolph Camilli in 1939, and then Hack Wilson in 1930. Now, it's part of his name. His name's Hack. You know, give him a break. But yeah, leading in striking. But you know, that year, Hack Wilson only struck out 84 times. So,
right.
You know, that's not
that was a different era.
That's not the end of the world. Right, exactly. And he walked 105. So, pretty elite company there. But it is kind of interesting that National League batters don't do that very often, you know, whereas, of course, the American League seem to be doing it all the time. I don't know if you caught the Night of the Hunter recently. I guess it was a few nights, not the great Robert Mitchum movie. But until this year, there had been just 3 days in the history of baseball, two of them last September, in which more than one guy whose first name was Hunter hit a home run. Then this May, for about a week or so, there were Hunters homering every time you tuned in. May 5th, Hunter Dozier and Hunter Renfro. May 6th, Hunter Dozier, Hunter Renfro. May 7th, Hunter Pence, who's having a bit of a renaissance in his late career. And then May 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, Pence Renfro. I forgot to check out Torrey Hunter, but that's for another day, I guess, right?
That's pretty funny. Word name play, just
yeah.
You didn't think that would be a necessarily common name, although I do know a Hunter.
Really?
Yes. He's not a baseball player.
Is he
player.
A pitcher?
Oh, no, he's not.
Okay. So of course we saw Chris Sale doing his thing, getting 17 strikeouts the other night and not getting a win, which just goes to show how stupid the win category is. In a start in which he only got 21 outs. Now, no pitcher has ever piled up that many Ks in an outing of 7 innings or fewer, but Chris Sale wasn't the first pitcher to strike out his 17th batter of a game in the 7th inning back in September 18th, 1996, on his second time around on his way to a 20-strikeout game. Of course, the Rocket, who threw an almost unheard of nowadays, 151 pitchers, Roger Clemens whiffed Travis Fryman for the final out of the 7th inning and his 17th strikeout. Now, of course, Chris Sale wanted to go stick around and see if he could hit 20. They had other ideas for toothpick arm. But he and Sale are the only two pitchers to have ever done that in the past 100 years. Kind of makes you wonder if they let Sale pitch 151, how many he might have got that night, which is kind of strange because Sale's had terrible start to the year. He wasn't striking out anybody.
Yeah, he had a rough April, but May
just figured it out.
The calendar turned, and now he's showing his ace form again.
Pretty insane. But speaking of K-Town, Josh Hader. Yeah, did you even notice? Did you even see that? What the hell was going on?
People
here?
Away.
He had possibly the most dominant stretch of pitching in maybe baseball history.
That was pretty amazing.
Starting April 15th. His 8-outing stretch, which began April 15th and ended over the weekend, he was insane. April 15th, 3 strikeouts, 3 outs. April 19th, 3 strikeouts, 3 outs. 21st, 3 strikeouts, 3 outs. April 27th, 5 strikeouts, 6 outs. Blah, blah, blah. Keeps going until May 8th with a total of 26 strikeouts with 28 outs.
Wow. We're
talking 9 1/3 innings here with 26 strikeouts. 25 of them in a 9-inning stretch, which is insane.
Right, that's frightening close to that perfect game. Is that even possible?
What, a
perfect game thrown with 27 strikeouts?
I believe that would be called an immaculate game.
Is that an immaculate game?
Well, it's never been done and never will be done, but, well, never say never. But how many pitchers in the expansion era have ever had any 9-inning span in which 25 of the 27 outs were strikeouts?
I can't think of any.
Well, according to the Elias Sports Bureau, that would be 0,
okay,
of course.
Okay, well, that's a good thing that I can't
Jesus
think of any.
Jesus Christ. Yeah, that is insane. But you're right. I guess the ultimate would be... Well, okay, no, I guess it wouldn't be the immaculate unless you did it with... What would that be?
That would 27 pitches. No, it would be 27 times
81 pitches.
Forcing me to do math 82? On the fly in my head. Come on now.
81, right?
Three I'm times not crazy. 3 times 9, right?
9 times 9, right? This is pathetic. Send your hate mail.
9 times 9, yeah, 81. 81. Yes.
Okay, all right. I'm not completely out of my mind. This is sad. This is turning into just a self-help episode. Please email your therapy concerns to baseballshowpodcast@gmail.com. Wow. It's been a hell of a couple weeks, and we've been going. I know we took a week off, but one thing I do want to see before the end of this year, and I know it's only May, but I'd like to see King Crush, a.k.a. Chris Davis, finish the year with 247. Now, he has 250 right now.
No, so he's hitting above his normal average.
He's hitting just above it. But, of course, he was the first qualified batter in the history of the game to finish 4 consecutive seasons with the same batting average, 247. Now, generally, if you hit 247, you're like, all right, that was an off year. But if you hit 40 home runs, it's, you know, kind of makes up for it. But he's currently at the hovering around the 250 mark. So, you know, we'll see, man. That I think that'd be pretty cool. Right?
It's entirely possible, too. He is nothing but the model of consistency, it would seem. Is that it? Is it, you have nothing, have nothing else? Thought you were going to keep going. I have one last thing about our favorite team in common to hate, the San Diego Padres. With another Ignoble Award candidate. It definitely deserves mentioning, but a record streak of consecutive games with no hitters. Now belongs to the Padres, surpassing the Mets.
What do you mean? But they already had. They're still the only team without a no hitter.
The Mets have a no hitter. But we're talking about time between no hitters, whether or not there has been a no hitter or not. It has now been 8,021 games after today
that
the Padres have failed to complete a no hitter.
Right. Which means they have had zero.
Zero in their history.
Right. They're the last team to do it.
The Mets at 8,019 games was the previous record.
Well,
of a stretch of games with no. No hitters.
That is quite an ignoble. That might be the ignoble award of the year, but
well, we'll see at the end of the year.
Decade. But you know, look, they have one of the best pitchers they've had in a long time, and Paddock. So if anybody's going to do it, could be him.
Could be him. Although not this year, maybe next year. Does he have the stuff?
He has the stuff, but I don't think he's ever gone even more than like 105 innings in his career in any one year. So we'll see if they limit him, and certainly if he's even getting close to a no hitter. They might have to Rich Hill him, you know, or Dave Roberts him, I guess I should say. Although that was a perfect game Rich Hill had going, so.
Right.
Pretty brutal stuff. Yeah, that's pretty bad. That is pretty and quite ignoble. But that brings us to last week's trivia question.
Last week's trivia question was about geography.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, so Coors Field and Chase Field are the two highest stadiums in terms of elevation. Coors sits at 5,197 feet above sea level, and Chase Field in Arizona sits at 1,059 feet above sea level. What is the third highest stadium in Major League Baseball?
Yeah, that's a good one. That, you know, that got my gears going a little bit, because obviously Chase and Coors are the clear, in a way, front runners, and I'm assuming third place isn't even 1,000 feet, although it's probably close.
It is close, but you're right, it is not quite 1,000 feet.
Alrighty, we got Girardi Joe in Chico says Kauffman Stadium, Kansas City.
That is a very good guess, but it is incorrect.
I believe that's fourth, correct?
I may very well be, yes.
At 886. Pretty good guess. In fact, as good as you could possibly get without getting it. Unfortunately, that is incorrect. We got Mikey S. in San Dimas says PNC Park. Yeah, San Dimas High School football rules, bro. PNC Park, the Pirates.
The Pirates, ooh, no.
That's what I was thinking.
That's what you were thinking?
Yeah. No,
that's
I know incorrect. They're like on the river.
They're
but
right
I,
on the river. The river's thought, usually the lowest point in the area.
I know. Let me look this up. No. Okay. Okay. Well, they're sixth. They're sixth, actually.
Sixth. Okay.
724 feet. That's actually not bad.
Yeah.
All right. So. Oh. Oh, I think. Okay. Yeah. All right. What
so,
is it?
So,
what is it? No, no winners. No winners.
No, no winners this week.
Very close.
Do you have another guess, knowing that it's not Pittsburgh?
I do.
Okay.
I'm thinking it's hot, it's humid, it's ATL.
It is Atlanta. Their third stadium in the city of Atlanta, SunTrust Park.
Yeah, I was thinking Turner, but they're basically like within a mile of each other, right? So
no, it's on the other side of town.
Oh, is it?
What I heard, it is a complete different area than where Turner Field and where stadium Atlanta Fulton County Stadium was once known as the launching pad, because it was known for how well the balls traveled there.
Mm.
Having to do with elevation of the city? Well, quite possibly.
And it's warm.
But SunTrust Field, the current home of the Atlanta Braves, is at 981 feet.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So that's up there. I mean, it's nowhere near 5,000, but no. That goes without saying. All right. Well, there we go. Man, I got one this week. What do you have for me this week? Remember to email us at baseballshowpodcast@gmail.com. Leave your answers. Leave a comment with your answer on the Podomatic website, iTunes, Stitcher,
Facebook.
However the hell you listen to us. Yeah, you know where to do it. We will see it. We are omniscient. We see everything. Okay. What do you got? What do you got for me this week?
Well, so I have a West Coast bias history question for y'all.
Ooh,
this week I got so what pitcher won 25 or more games three times during the 1960s without winning a Cy Young?
Ooh, 25
games or more,
Jesus,
in a season three times in the
1960s. Mm, okay. Interesting. Which pitcher won 25 or more games three times in the 1960s without winning a Cy Young Award winner? The answer.
Next time on West Coast Bias Baseball Podcast. Thank you for listening.
I am Adam Nelson.
And I am Samuel Paul. Remember, baseball is life. The rest, just details.
Go watch some baseball.